say the West should stop provoking Russia and instead put the best interests of citizens first. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
France's ambassador to Mali has been kicked out of the country in a major blow to the neo-colonial sphere of influence known as Françafrique. The reasons included undiplomatic language from Paris towards a new military government in the capital of Bamako, but also sanctions on Mali, which have raised food prices, and especially the failure of almost a decade of French-led war. France first declared war in overwhelmingly Muslim Mali without the United Nations' approval, allegedly to fight religious extremists. 9 years later, with thousands dead and a million refugees, public opinion has turned massively against France.
Polls show that 80% of Malians in the capital think that France was only there to defend French interests. It's an opinion which Paris has blamed on Russian disinformation.
Public opinion is also reportedly strongly supportive of expelling the French ambassador, as well as of the military.
Dans la vision occidentale,
in the Western vision of things, there isn't a desire to respect the majority will of these people, or to help install a minimum of democracy, and thus a government with a minimum of credibility. If you install a government which is pro-Western and which doesn't reflect the popular will, then of course you will create anti-occupation sentiment because you become a hostile force yourself.
The bold move by Mali comes just days after Burkina Faso's military seized the heads of state, even as French soldiers were on a mission in the country. In the past 18 months, other revolts, in Guinea as well as in Chad and Niger, have many wondering if France is losing its neo-colonial hold on sub-Saharan Africa.
Les intérêts français dans la région.
France's interests in the region are threatened by new players such as China, Russia, and even Qatar, which has invested a lot there. We can no longer say this is a region which is under total French domination, because there is now competition. However, as long as the local governments are corrupt, they can be easily influenced by foreign powers.
France's military has stalled for time, saying a total military withdrawal from Mali will be discussed in the coming days. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip staged a rally organized by the Women Framework of the Islamic Jihad movement to voice their support for Palestinians in Negev region in southern parts of the occupied Palestinian territories. The protesters denounced the Israeli regime for violating the rights of locals in Negev and demolishing their homes.
We are here today to support Palestinians in Negev. Israeli regime is trying to demolish our identity by taking over these lands and expelling the Palestinians. Our message is that we will never accept such crimes. All the Palestinians are facing the same struggle and we will remain united.
In recent days, hundreds of Palestinians in Negev have staged protests against the land confiscation by the so-called Jewish National Fund, an organization that collects money from Jews around the world to seize the Palestinian property. The Israeli regime has suppressed the demonstrations, arresting dozens of Palestinians.
Israel has stolen all what is Palestinian for a long time, but our Palestinian resistance keep defending the Palestinian rights by all means, even the armed resistance. Our enemy used every possible chance to press ahead with its apartheid policies of land grabbing, but our national resistance never hesitate to fight in the face of these crimes in all parts of Palestine.
Palestinians are all united in the face of the Israeli occupation and reject as illegal and unacceptable the Israeli land grab policy.
This event is held to voice our support for Palestinians in Negev who are under Israeli illegal land grab policy. This Israeli regime is expelling Palestinians from their lands and replacing them with settlers. We tell them that we maintain our unity and fight back, while we urge the international community to take a serious step to end such crimes.
The number of Palestinians in Negev is estimated at 300,000. Estimates show that they are living on 5% of the land, 95% of which confiscated by Israel. Israel has seized more Palestinian lands in Nakab in the past few years. Protesters here say this is an attempt to expel the Palestinian population from the area, which amounts to crime against humanity. They also stress that Palestinians in Nakab are not alone in their struggle. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Iran's biggest cinematic event, the 40th edition of Fajr Film Festival, is underway, playing host to high-profile Iranian filmmakers, critics, and cineasts in Iran's iconic Milad Tower. The annual event rolled down the red carpet for the first time in 2 years, as the festival was held with limited presence last year.
Fajr Film Festival was held without public presence last year due to the pandemic. But this year, we decided to hold it with health protocols in place. Some 61 movie theaters across the country are screening the participating films. That's around 14,000 chairs. But the halls run with 50% of their capacities to comply with the health protocols. Filmgoers are required to show their vaccination card with at least 2 doses. We have also set up vaccination booths for those who have not got their 3rd jabs.
A lineup of 22 films, mostly made by the new generation of Iranian filmmakers, are competing for a Crystal Simorgh as the top prize of the festival. Among the competing films is Murtaza Ali Abbas Mirzai's Beiro, a sport drama on the life of Iranian goalkeeper Ali Raza Behrahnvand, who made a name for himself after catching Cristiano Ronaldo's penalty kick. The Loser Man by Mohammad Hossein Mahdavian and The Situation of Mehdi by Hadi Hejazifar are other highlights of the lineup. After each film is screened, the cast and crew attend a Q&A session with journalists and cineasts.
Fajr Film Festival provides professional and specialized feedbacks on our performances as actors and filmmakers. And it's such criticisms and feedbacks that make us find our deficiencies and try to improve.
Recently, an important and new development has taken place in Fajr Film Festival, and that is the festival is no longer specific for veteran filmmakers, and we see that younger but talented filmmakers also participate and win a prize, so it's changing the film industry for the better.
10 memorable films from renowned Iranian directors will be reviewed in the Classics Preserved section of the Fajr Film Festival. Among them is Abbas Kiarostami's 1987 Where's the Friend's House and Majid Majidi's 1999 Oscar-nominated film Children of Heaven. Fajr Film Festival is held every year on the anniversary of the victory of Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution. The 40th edition of the 10-day event kicked off on February 1st and will wrap up with the announcement of winners on February 11th.
Fajr Film Festival is Iran's most iconic cinematic event, and the movies that win a Crystal Simorgh will go down in the list of Iran's blockbusters. This makes it a tough competition among the participating films, so they all must be worthy of watching on the big screen. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
More than a dozen colleges and universities in many U.S. cities, from Baltimore to New Orleans, had to lock down or suspend classes as they received threats of bombing and mass shooting. That's on the first day of Black History Month, a time to honor, commemorate, and celebrate African-American history and culture. Most of these institutions were founded in the years after the American Civil War, but Howard University was also among those threatened on Tuesday. The White House said it is taking the threat seriously, but added that it is still unclear what could have motivated those threats. However, the issue is not an isolated one, as the U.S. intelligence last year warned about racially motivated possible attacks by extremists, such as white supremacists.
HBCUs, like many other institutions in the Black community, become targets when issues of race, issues of civil rights, issues of equality bubble to the surface and become the focal point of American society. Whenever African Americans begin to kind of push for rights, push for recognition, our institutions have been targeted by those who seek to silence those voices.
The threats come as the United States remains a fertile ground for injustice, with the country being criticized for racial profiling, use of excessive force, and discrimination against minorities. The killing of George Floyd in 2020 is one of numerous examples of how African Americans are being treated in a country claimed to be the defender of human rights. Floyd is one among a dozen of recent black victims that gained global attention and sparked protests at home and abroad against U.S. police brutality. According to a U.S. media report, about 1 in 1,000 African Americans can expect to die at the hands of police in their lifetime, almost double that of their white counterparts.
In each generation, for every several years, there needs to be a major fight in order for black Americans to win equality and equity in the country. And now at a time when we're starting to see strides happening with more educated black Americans, black women are the most educated ethnic group in our country. When we're seeing these strides, we are also seeing a commensurate white lash that we have seen historically whenever black Americans increase their autonomy, increase their agency, and increase their socioeconomic mobility.
The racism is deep-rooted in the U.S. society, with discrimination being seen institutionalized in both political and economic domains. The attack on Capitol Hill last year was the culmination of the same, as rioters blatantly and proudly carried symbols of hate, meaning the attack had much to do with race in America. In the aftermath, threats against blacks and people of color became more evident. Repeated threats, shootings, and lack of transparency have already terrorized America's black community. It is feared that the country may be heading for more unrest and a dangerous divide if the country's leadership and politicians fail to act upon their long-cherished dream of equality.
At 11:30 a.m. Monday, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson received an important email. In the attachment, a damning report into alleged parties under his roof last year. Among other things, a 13-page report by senior civil servant Sue Gray looked at 16 gatherings during the pandemic and found that the behavior was difficult to justify, with failures of leadership and judgment, and too little thought was given to what was happening across the country.
The complete version of the Sue Gray report is yet to be published, pending a police investigation. But the sheer scale of potential breaches meant that Boris Johnson had to face furious MPs in the building in penitent mode. Again.
I want to apologize. I know that millions of people across this country have made extraordinary sacrifices over the last 18 months.
To the opposition, sorry was not enough.
The British public aren't fools. They never believed a word of it. They think the Prime Minister should do the decent thing and resign. Of course he won't, because he is a man without shame.
He has been investigated by the police. He misled the House. He must now resign.
Members of the Prime Minister's own party didn't pull any punches either.
Either my right honourable friend had not read the rules, or didn't understand what they meant, and others around him, or they didn't think the rules applied to number 10. Which was it?
And while the Prime Minister and the people around him were allegedly having a good time away from prying eyes, the rest of the people adhered to the rules. Those who didn't were stopped unceremoniously.
What it would take for this Prime Minister to go, I don't know. If this doesn't get in his way, then God help us all, frankly, in terms of politics in this country.
People are sceptical, and I think a lot of people also kind of think with the police, you know, quite rightly, obviously, number 10, there's a police presence. So people in the police were aware that, or should have been aware that, you know, something was going on in the back garden.
While people were dying and while people were unable to attend funerals, for him to be holding parties and agreeing to parties to be held when he made the rules is fairly immoral.
The public mood here is one of outrage at the moment, but experts say what Boris Johnson desperately needs now is not public support, but the backing of his own party members to avoid a leadership challenge. Saeed Purizep, London.
Yemeni health workers have staged a demonstration inside the Ministry of Health in Yemen's capital Sana'a to warn that over 300 health facilities are on the verge of collapse due to the severe fuel shortage. They slammed the continued detention of Yemeni oil vessels by Saudi Arabia and its allies.
The health sector is suffering greatly due to the lack of fuel, as health officials suffer from a shortage in electrical power generations to save the lives of thousands of patients. Intensive care units, oxygen factories, operation rooms, emergency rooms, and other divisions will stop, and this is a crime against the Yemeni people. Unfortunately, the international community remains silent about what is happening. The United Nations has failed to fulfill its duties.
The Ministry of Health has called on the international community to step in and to pressure the Saudi-led coalition to release the detained oil vessels and save the lives of thousands of Yemeni patients who may lose their lives as a result of the Saudi blockade on the country.
Banning the entry of fuel ships and piracy on Yemeni oil ships lead to a health catastrophe, as hospitals and health centers are in constant need of fuel. The interruption means that health services will stop working. Some patients come from other governorates to get treatment in Sana'a, such as cancer patients, and the fuel crisis will make their transportation even more difficult. We warn of an imminent health disaster and call on the international community to do its part to save the lives of thousands of Yemeni patients, including children.
Recently, the member of Yemen's negotiating delegation, Abdul Malik al-Hajri, passed away of kidney failure as he could not travel abroad for treatment due to the continued closure of Sana'a International Airport that comes as Saudi Arabia and its allies have imposed an all-out blockade on Yemen since March 2015.
The lives of thousands of Yemeni patients, including children, are in danger amid the absence of essential healthcare services. Unfortunately, the inaction of the international community towards the catastrophic situation in Yemen is emboldening the Saudi-led coalition to further continue its crimes in the war-ravaged country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Omani Foreign Minister Badr al-Busaidi met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. The two sides discussed bilateral relations and recent regional developments. During the talks, Assad referred to both countries' mutual understanding of regional issues, asserting that Arabs need to conduct realistic dialogue and set up necessary bases for political relations among each other. He stressed that developments in the Arab world require a change of their political approach. For his part, Busaidi conveyed to Assad greetings of the Omani Sultan, underlining Syria's strong and brave stances in facing regional challenges.
We look forward to strengthening our economic, trade and political relations. I discussed in detail such relations with my Syrian counterpart. There are efforts made by many countries currently to bring Arabs together, correct mistakes of the past, and adopt a more futuristic vision for Arab cooperation in order to overcome the past.
For his part, Syrian Foreign Minister underlined the significance of collaboration with Oman for bringing Arabs together.
The meeting was an opportunity to discuss joint Arab action and solidarity, as well as establishing the best relations among Arab states in order to correct previous mistakes and build the future. Syria and Oman formed together a force for underlining the importance of a united Arab stance to overcome challenges facing our countries and peoples.
Oman has been working for years on alleviating tension between Arab countries, mainly with regards to Syria. He arrived in Damascus coming from Kuwait, where Arab foreign ministers were meeting. The significance of Oman's strategy towards Syria is that it did not sever its ties, as many Arab countries did during the crisis. The visit comes as Arab countries are gradually restoring relations with Syria following the victory of the country's government against terror. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Israeli forces have escalated their arrest campaigns throughout the occupied territories, detaining dozens of Palestinians in raids across the occupied West Bank early Monday. The Palestinian Prisoner Society revealed that the arrests were made mainly in Ain al-Sultan camp in Ariha, also known as Jericho, and Al-Jalazon refugee camp in Ramallah, as well as in a number of villages west of the city. The society accused Israel of trying to find different excuses to raid Palestinian areas. This time, the Israeli army announced that its forces operating in the West Bank were exposed to fire more than once by Palestinian resistance fighters.
The reasons behind arresting Palestinians this time are many and different. And the goal is to drain the energy of the Palestinian people, in which they won't resist Israel, the occupation. The Israeli tries through detention to convince the people that there is no way to achieve victory.
Israeli forces continue to storm Palestinian villages and cities on a daily basis under the excuse of arresting Palestinian activists. In the village of Qatani, northwest occupied Al-Quds, two Palestinians were shot and seriously wounded before they were detained.
These campaigns are part of Israeli oppression that aims at breaking the Palestinian resistance to occupation. But they will not succeed. And in my opinion, all these arrests reflect the crisis of the Israeli system that does not understand that Palestinians will never give up.
Palestinians warn that Israel's escalated crackdown against the activists and the use of excessive force is meant to fight the Palestinian resistance. They see the operations as a failed attempt to intimidate the youth into giving up resistance. Israel holds thousands of Palestinians, including women and minors, in jail. Israel intensifies its arrest campaigns against Palestinians under the pretext of a policy known as mowing the lawn, which is aimed at re-arresting Palestinian activists to prevent any forms of resistance. Experts say these detentions remain as part of Tel Aviv's perpetual war against the Palestinians. Mona Qandil, Occupy Ramallah.
This is Foresight. A program on how to worship Allah.
Allah, 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 Allah.
Today's great tip: what are the secrets of believing in what you say? And the enhancement and strengthening of our ubudiyah, our servitude to Allah.
Allah, Allah, Rabbi, la sharika lahu.
So, dear listeners, when we're talking about believing in what we say, of course, this is something that seems to just roll off our tongues. To believe in what you say. But in reality, this statement is quite profound. We find that truly believing in what you say makes a world of difference when it comes to our ubudiyah, our servitude to Allah, our obedience to Allah, and our worship of Allah the Almighty. Now, of course, it's very easy to say, La ilaha illallah. There is no God but Allah. But to truly believe in this statement, perhaps it might take a lifetime. Now, of course, we have different levels of belief. So, for example, on a very superficial level, yes, we all believe that there is no God, there is no deity other than Allah, the Almighty, the Exalted. But the more you go towards the certainty and the yaqeen and the certainty again of this statement, and we truly start to believe what we are saying, we will of course see that our ubudiyah will become greatly enhanced and greatly maximized by this means. And so we find that, for example, even the name of Allah the Exalted and the seal of the prophets, the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, the noble religion of Islam, the divine sacred book, the Holy Quran, the imams of guidance, and other knowledge and ma'arifah, which have not been conveyed to our heart, meaning we have not believed in the depths of our heart. These things, such as even the name of Allah and the name of the Holy Prophet and the religion of Islam and the Quran and the Imams, divinely guided Imams, if we do not find them in our heart and we do not have them deeply in our heart, they will surely be forgotten. And they will be forgotten not just in this life, but they will be forgotten when we pass on to the next life.
Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Ya
Allah. IRIB English Radio.
Our website is farstoday.com.
Ya Allah, Ya Rahman, haqqat amanina, waffiqna fi kulli an fi ma sa'ina. Ya Allah, Ya Mannan, haqqat amanina, waffiqna fi kulli an fi ma sa'ina. Ajib du'ai, ya raja'i, bil-rida wal-khair. أنير طريقي مع صديقي باحترام الغير. يا الله يا رحمن حقق أمانينا.
Dear listeners of the program Foresight, my name is Muhammad. Today I'd like to read to you an excerpt from Munajatul Khaifin, the whispered prayer of the fearful. Please stay with me.
أنا العبد الفقير وأنا أعيش وصاحب القلق نهاري دونكم ليل وليلي كله
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. My God, what thinkest you? Will you chastise me after my faith in you? Drive me far away after my love for you? Deprive me while I hope for your mercy and forgiveness? Forsake me while I seek sanctuary in your pardon? How could your generous face disappoint me? I wish that I know. Did my mother bear me for wretchedness? Did she nurture me for suffering? If such, then I wish that she had not borne me and had not nurtured me. I wish that I had knowledge. Have you appointed me one of the people of felicity? Have you singled me out for your nearness and neighborhood? Then would my eyes be gladdened, and in that my soul reach serenity.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Foresight on IRIB English Radio. In continuation to what we were saying as far as the secrets of believing in what we say, and when we believe in what we say, we end up enhancing and increasing and strengthening and really maximizing our ubudiyya, our servitude to Allah. We said that if certain things do not penetrate into the depths of our heart and our soul, even if they are things as simple as the name of Allah and the name of the seal of the prophets, the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and the name of the noble religion of Islam, and even the name of the Quran, and even the names of the divinely appointed imams of the household of the Holy Prophet, and other kinds of knowledge and ma'rifah, if they have not penetrated into the depths of our heart and our soul, they will be forgotten. And not only will they be forgotten in this world, but when we pass on to the next world, they will be forgotten as well. And is this not the case? For example, if we do not firmly believe in something, even if it is something like La ilaha illallah, the kalima, there is no God but Allah, if we don't firmly believe it, then we will forget it, not just in terms of our tongue and our minds or our memory, but in terms of it being in our hearts. Our heart will forget this. And it will forget it to an extent where even when we are questioned in the grave, we won't be able to answer. Right? The grave is supposed to be a situation which is stressful. It is scary. It is frightening. Right? Because we are being transferred from one realm to another realm. And amongst this fear and this stress and this anxiety and this tension, of course, things that have not penetrated deep into our hearts and our souls, we won't be able to answer. The talqeen, which is the recitation of this remembrance of the name of Allah and the name of the Prophet and the name of the Quran and the name of the imams, etc., this recitation of the talqeen will be of no avail to us, because we won't find any trace in our heart of the truth of Allah's rububiyyah, His lordship, or the truth of nubuwwah, prophethood, or any other knowledge in ma'rifah which we have acquired. But we merely used to talk about these things, and we had no real image of these concepts and these truths deep in our heart, and thus they will vanish from our memory, and we will be left empty-handed. And so truly, we must slowly but surely believe truly in what we say in order to enhance and strengthen our ubudiyah, our obedience and our servitude to Allah.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is farshtoday.com.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
There are many beautiful, beautiful promises of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for the mu'mineen and mu'minat. In order to be considered mu'min and a believer according to the Quran, we have to have intellectual conviction that Islam is the truth. It's not a religion that I'm following because of my forefathers or anybody else. I personally am convinced this is Islam, this is the truth. In order to be considered mu'min is that, different than other faiths, it's not going to be a religion where my iman or my faith is only in my heart. The Quran specifies and teaches us that if you are mu'min in Islam, that iman is going to demonstrate itself in our actions. Islam is not a buffet. It's a package deal. Someone who is a Muslim has intellectual conviction that the Quran is the book of God, that Imam Ali is really the first Imam. This person has to embrace all of Islam. Picking and choosing in Islam does not lead one to be considered mu'min, and the promises of God are not for those who are not mu'mineen. So, back to the topic. The topic is that God, the creator of the universe, has confidence in you and I. Some of us might not think of ourselves as a champion, as someone who's a game changer, but what's important is how God views us. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And by the way, sisters, this promise that I'm going to share you the verse of Quran with you, this promise that we're going to be sharing and inshallah pondering on and then taking benefit from, is a promise which means no matter what the challenge in life I've been given, Allah has confidence in. It might be dealing with family. Sometimes people have marital issues. Sometimes their children are not doing what they would like. Sometimes their spouse, sometimes relatives. That might be one challenge. It might be a personal challenge. Sometimes someone is a mu'min or mu'mina, maybe not in this community, but it happens. Somebody's even dealing with something as like addiction, be a personal struggle that the person is going through. Sometimes it might be financial issues. You'd be surprised, inshallah, all of you are doing very well financially. Sometimes for mu'mineen and mu'minat, the struggles they're going through, they can't even explain to you and I. Sometimes people are going through financial issues. Sometimes it's a lawsuit. They look on the other side of the equation, on the other side of the table. The enemy seems so powerful. Those who are after them are so strong. But again, Allah believes in me. I can do it. I'm up to the task. It might be long-term health issues.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Ya fuadi, da'asi wallah, fawid al-amra lillahi lillah, kul wa nadi, hasbi Allah, kul fama khab abdun da'a Allah. لا إله سواه لا تخالطه الظنون ولا العيون تراه الله جل في علاه هو أنسي وملاذي أحتمي بحماه حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل نعم المولى ونعم النصير حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل نعم المولى ونعم النصير حسبنا الله حسبنا الله حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل حسبنا الله حسبنا الله
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
According to recent revelations, former US President Donald Trump thinks his own Vice President Mike Pence should be investigated by the committee investigating the 6th of January attack on the Capitol for failing to reject Electoral College results on that fateful day. We have prepared for you an article written by Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled Trump tore up records turned over to House Capitol Attack Committee. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. The National Archives said some of the White House records turned over to the House Committee investigating the 6th of January attack were ripped up by former US President Donald Trump. It also emerged on Tuesday, 1st of February, that the former president thinks his own Vice President Mike Pence should be investigated by the committee for failing to reject Electoral College results on that fateful day. Documents obtained by the 6th of January panel include diaries, schedules, handwritten notes, speeches, and remarks. The Supreme Court rejected Donald Trump's attempt to stop the National Archives turning them over to Congress. In a statement, the National Archives said, "Some of the Trump presidential records received by the National Archives and Records Administration included paper records that had been torn up by former President Donald Trump." The National Archives added, "These were turned over to the National Archives at the end of the Trump administration, along with a number of torn-up records that had not been reconstructed by the White House." The Presidential Records Act requires that all records created by presidents be turned over to the National Archives at the end of their administrations. The archives did not say how it knew Trump had torn the records, but his habit of tearing up documents has been widely reported. In 2018, the website Politico spoke to Solomon Larty, a records management analyst who spent time armed with rolls of clear scotch tape, sifting through large piles of paper and putting them back together like a jigsaw puzzle. They said summarily, Solomon Larty and another staffer who taped records were fired by the White House that year. Larty said, "They told Donald Trump to stop doing it. He didn't want to stop." After a process that reached the Supreme Court, the National Archives gave more than 700 documents concerning the Capitol attack to the House Committee recently. More than 700 people have been charged over the riot, in which Donald Trump's supporters tried to stop certification of his election defeat. 11 members of a far-right militia group are charged with seditious conspiracy. More than 100 police officers were injured on that day. 7 people died. The committee has recommended criminal charges for 2 Trump associates, the former White House strategist Steve Bannon and Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. Steve Bannon refused cooperation and pleaded not guilty to contempt of Congress. Mark Meadows cooperated, then withdrew his support. He has not been charged. In a surprise statement on Tuesday, 1st of February, Donald Trump said he thought Mike Pence should be subject to the committee's attentions. He said his vice president should be investigated because he did not send back the votes for recertification or approval, in that it has now been shown that he clearly had the right to do so. Mike Pence concluded that he did not have the right to reject Electoral College results and resisted pressure from Donald Trump to do so. He was rewarded with the attentions of the mob that stormed the Capitol building, some chanting for him to be hanged. Donald Trump has seized on moves in the Senate to reform the Electoral Count Act of 1887, mainly by removing ambiguity over the vice president's role. Constitutional scholars agree the vice president does not have the right to reject results, even under the act as written. Mark Short and Greg Jacob, close aides to Mike Pence, have reportedly spoken to the 6th of January committee recently. Both men were present at an infamous Oval Office meeting on 4th of January 2021, when John Eastman, a constitutional scholar, tried to convince Mike Pence he could reject Electoral College results. Regarding the torn-up White House materials turned over to the committee, Stephen Gillers, a New York University law professor, told the Washington Post Destroying White House documents could be a crime under several statutes that make it a crime to destroy government property if that was the intent of the defendant. Stephen Gillis said, "A president does not own the records generated by his own administration. The definition of a presidential records is broad. Trump's own notes of himself could qualify, and destroying them could be the criminal destruction of government property." Donald Trump did not comment on the National Archives statement, nor did the House committee. It was also reported on Tuesday, 1st of February, that text messages were turned over to the House Committee by Kayleigh McEnany, Donald Trump's last press secretary. ABC News reported that Kayleigh McEnany appeared before the investigators on 13th of January. It also said the texts were the source of conversations with the Fox News host Sean Hannity, which were quoted by the committee in a request for information from Ivanka Trump, the former president's daughter and advisor. Sean Hannity texted Kayleigh McEnany after the Capitol attack, "1. No more stolen election talk." Referring to possible attempts to remove Trump from power, he added, "2. Yes, impeachment and the 25th Amendment are real and many people will quit." McEnany replied, "Love that, thank you. That is the playbook. I will help reinforce." Donald Trump was impeached but acquitted. The 25th Amendment, which provides for the removal of a president incapable of fulfilling his or her duties, was not invoked. Donald Trump continues to claim the election was stolen. McEnany is now a Fox News host. She and her employer did not comment. One former Trump White House insider told The Guardian, "She's an honest woman."
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, dear brothers and sisters, Salamun alaikum. So welcome to this episode of Lantern. Now we'll listen to today's story. The title of the story is The Beggar King. Let's start. Once a country was ruled by a king who had no son to succeed to the throne. Since the king was getting old, he wanted to select a suitable heir to rule the country. The king sent out notices throughout his country. The notices invited every qualified young man in the country for an interview with the king. The only qualification for the candidate was that they should have immense love for their fellow human beings. Every young man across the country was very excited at the possibilities of being the ruler of the country. A poor young man from a remote village also read the notice and started to prepare for an interview with the king. The man was a kind, hard-working lad, but he was very poor due to various circumstances. The man had no good clothes to be presentable in the sight of the king, so the young man worked really hard and saved some money to buy him proper clothes and supplies to support him for a long journey to the palace. After he got his supplies and a proper attire for the interview,
The young man set out on his quest. He traveled many days and hard and had almost completed the journey when he came upon a poor beggar by the side of the road. The poor beggar sat trembling in the cold, covered only in tattered rags. The beggar extended his arms and pleaded for help. His weak voice croaked, "I'm hungry and cold. Please help me, sir." The young man was so moved by the pathetic condition of the beggar that he immediately stripped his new attire and offered it to him. He also provided him with his very limited food he had carried for the journey. The beggar thanked the man immensely. Since the man had given up his good clothes to the beggar, he was a bit hesitant to go for the interview. He, however, gathered enough courage to enter the palace in his old dirty clothes. Upon his arrival at the palace, the king's attendants showed him the way to the great hall. The young man bowed low as the king entered the room. When he raised his eyes, he gasped in astonishment as he noticed that the king looked very similar to the beggar he met on the way. Yeah, the king saw the shock in the man's eye and said, "Yes, I was the beggar you met on your way." "But why did you dress up like a beggar? You are the king." "Well then, why did you do this to me?" the young man stammered after gaining some composure. "Because I had to be sure that you had a good heart and you genuinely love your fellow human beings," said the king. "I know that if I came to you as king, you would have done anything to impress me, but that way I would never have known what is truly in your heart. Beggar had nothing to offer you. The generosity and love to the one in need without expecting anything in return is the sign of a great heart. You have proved that you are the right person to be my successor," promised the king. "Kindness is more important than wisdom, and the recognition of this is the beginning of wisdom."
Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In this episode, we are going to talk about the necessity of helping the poor. In the Islamic religion, we find that it's indicated that the rich ought to help the poor. In a piece of divine discourse, that is Hadith Qudsi, divine discourse or divine Hadith, it's indicated, "Ya Ahmad, إِنَّ مَحَبَّةً لِلَّهِ هِيَ مَحَبَّةِ الْفَقَرَى وَالتَّقَرُّبَ إِلَيْهِمْ." O Muhammad, certainly the love of Allah, the love for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, finds expression in doing good to the poor. And then the poor have been defined as those people who are not well-to-do people, and they are content with the current situation. The situation of living in poverty. Yet they do need many other things that the well-to-do families enjoy. At the same time, we find that another characteristic is that those people who are not that much well-versed in Islamic teachings and moral education of the Islamic religion, they may say that the poor's patience against poverty comes from them not believing in whatever has been destined for them, from above or from the side of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Some people may say that the poor should always complain about their poverty, or the poor or people, those people who've been inflicted with, for example, natural disasters like, for example, flood or other things, are expected to groan about their own situation. to some degree, being not happy with natural disasters or, for example, poverty is quite common to everybody. However, those poor people who are at the same time good believers and practicing good and practicing believers, they try to be content with the situation on their own side. However, on the other side, the rich of the community, the rich people of the community, are expected to help them, to be attentive to the situation and to help them get out of the poverty. This is a communal duty. The duty of the rich in any community to be always thoughtful and cooperative with the poor, such that poverty wouldn't drive the poor to committing, for example, certain crimes like robbery, theft, or for example other crimes, other horrible crimes, in order to compensate the poverty. At the same time, it must be indicated that it's indicated in the Holy Quran that the ignorant people may regard the poor as rich, because the poor people are not those who will groan, who groan here and there about the poverty. Rather, they try to, the poor try to be content with whatever has been provided for them on the side of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. At the same time, we find that whenever the poor receive any help, any financial help, they thank Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and they express the gratitude to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for receiving some help. At the same time, another characteristic of the poor is that they wouldn't tell lies in order to deceive other people, help them get out of their poverty. Another characteristic of the poor is that they almost never get angry with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because it has been the destiny that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has decreed for them. And in many a case, we found that some people used to be good people and cooperative with each other so long as they experienced some sort of poverty. However, as soon as they became rich and they became affluent, they tried to usurp other people's rights. So we find that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala knows much better than anybody else in the world that who deserves, for example, wealth or not. It doesn't mean that those people who are wealthy people or the rich may not commit any crime. However, it must be indicated that this kind of poverty is a kind of test on the side of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for certain people. Thank you.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah.
Ana bi dhikrillahi tatma'innul qulub.
This is IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.